1820, speaking of the Bible, Sir William Scott declared, within that awful or great or reverential volume, within that awful volume lies the mystery of mysteries. One of the mysteries within that great mystery is the mystery of the Gentiles. This will be Mystery of the Gentiles, Part 3. Without question, it is a mystery of great significance, if for no other reason than that 3 out of 5 times it's mentioned in the New Testament as being associated with the greatest of mysteries, the mystery of the Christ. Let's turn to just one of those passages and read it. Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1, and we'll be reading verses 25 through 27. Verse 25, Wherefore I am made a minister according to the dispensation of God, which is given to me for you to fulfill the word of God, even the mystery which has been hid from ages and from generations, but now is made manifest to his saints, to whom God would make known what is the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, which is the Christ in you, the hope of glory. If the Gentiles were simply non-Israelites, as most of today's religious world believes and teaches, and I won't say that there wouldn't be any mystery in that. After all, it's a mystery that Yahweh would love any of us so much that while we were yet sinners, the Christ would die for us. That's a mystery in and of itself. But how much more mysterious would it be that if for centuries, all of 2,000 years, most of Christendom have completely misidentified the Gentiles, both in the Bible and in society? How much more mysterious if these people fulfilled prophecies that to date have never been recognized by the modern church world? How much more mysterious if these Gentiles, usually considered to be non-Israelites, were somehow genetically related to the Judahite Israelites? How much more mysterious if the salvation promised to these people had something to do with Yahweh's remarriage to those whom he had previously married and divorced? Now, I'm quite confident that everyone would agree that that would be much more mysterious than simply salvation being granted to non-Israelites. From the previous two messages, we've already uncovered that the Hebrew and Greek words, respectively goy and ethnos, are not the exclusionary terms that most of Judaized Christianity has tried to make them. For example, try inserting Gentiles or heathen or non-Jews into Genesis 25 and verse 23, where Rebekah is told about the twins Jacob and Esau in her womb. Here's how it reads in the King James. It says, "And Yahweh said unto her, Two nations," that's goy, "are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and one people will be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." Now try inserting some of these other terms that most of Judeo-Christianity interprets the word goy or the word Gentiles in the Bible. Try inserting the word Gentiles here. "And Yahweh said unto her, Two Gentiles are in thy womb." Of course they wouldn't translate it that way because they know it doesn't work that way. And so they translated it with the word nations as it should have been translated. Or how about heathen? "And Yahweh said unto her, Two nations are in thy womb," or excuse me, "And Yahweh said unto her, Two heathen are in thy womb." Well, somebody might say, well, there was at least one heathen, but there weren't. You wouldn't translate it as two heathen. Or how about two non-Jews, the way it's normally taken to mean? "And Yahweh said unto her, Two non-Jews are in thy womb." It just doesn't work. There were two goyim in her wombs, not one goyim and one Israelite. Try it in Genesis 48:19, where Jacob is blessing Joseph's son Ephraim. Genesis 48:19 reads, "I know it, my son, I know it. He also," speaking of Manasseh, "shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations," a multitude of goy. Or a multitude of non-Israelites? No, that doesn't work. A multitude of non-Jews? No, that doesn't work. A multitude of heathen? No, none of that works. Or how about in Jeremiah 31:36? And all of this just to demonstrate that there's much more to these words than the average Christian and even the average preacher today understands or preaches or teaches. Jeremiah 31:36, "And if those ordinances," speaking of the fixed order of the sun ruling by day and the moon ruling by night, It says, if those ordinances or fixed order depart from before me, saith Yahweh, then the seed of Israel shall cease from being a goy, a heathen before me forever, a non-Jew from before me forever, a non-Israelite from before me forever. No, I mean, it absolutely changes, it reverses the meaning to put non-Israelite in there for the word goy. No, it's translated as it should be. If those ordinances depart from before me, saith Yahweh, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. It's just not as simple as most 20th century preachers have attempted to make it. The same is true for the Greek word ethnos, usually translated Gentiles in the New Testament. It has a much broader use in the New Testament than most Christians have understood. Once again, for example, ethnos in the New Testament is translated Gentiles in Acts 7:45, used in reference to non-Israelites. Used in reference to heathens is translated Gentiles as well in 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 2. And you can look these up for yourselves. Translated nations, used in reference to a multitude of people, specifically the whole human race, Acts 17:26. In Luke 7:3 through 5 is translated nation, in this case used in reference to the Jewish people, i.e. descendants of the house of Judah. And then in Romans 9:24, it's once again translated Gentiles, used in reference in this case to Israelites, specifically descendants of the house of Israel. And we'll be looking more intently at that last passage, because that's usually the one that brings up the most questions as we get further into this message. The two words, goy and ethnos, are best defined and understood as, quote, any group of people of the same race, nationality, or genus who share a common and distinct culture, end of quote. Both words are best translated as nation or nations, simply as nation or nations. And by the way, you often hear someone speak of an individual being a Gentile. You know, they may say, I'm a Gentile, or so-and-so is a Gentile. However, the two terms goy and ethnos can never be used to identify an individual. That's, again, those are the two words that the word Gentile is usually translated from. But no, those two terms are never singular in implication. They are always plural of a collective group of people, a nation, or a plurality of collective groups of people, such as, in the plural, nations. But it's never, those two terms are never, can never be, from their original intent, be used to signify an individual. The foregoing scriptures and definitions provide us with an essential clue, a prerequisite that must be understood if we are ever to solve this Gentile mystery. That is, that there are both non-Israelite and Israelite Gentiles, no matter what the preachers across this land may be preaching today. And most of them are preaching it because they've never checked this out themselves. They've simply run with it because that's how they were taught. But if they will check it out, it is easily discovered that this is the case. Now, following are four more significant clues provided to us in the Old Testament. And here's where we're going to start becoming scriptural Sherlock Holmes in this message. We're going to start doing some digging and trying to uncover the clues that God does provide us in His Word for this Gentile mystery. These will be Old Testament provided clues, four more significant clues provided to us in the Old Testament. First, we're told that a part of the Israelites, specifically the 10 northern tribed house of Israel, were divorced by Yahweh and dispersed or scattered amongst the non-Israelite Gentiles. Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 8 is one place that establishes the fact that God indeed did divorce the house of Israel. Turning to Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 8. And of course, in order for him to divorce her, it needs to be understood and recognized, obviously, that he had also previously married her and her sister, the house of Judah, as they were at one time united as the united house of Israel, or the united kingdom of Israel. God had married them. But now he is going to, as we'll find out in this passage, divorce at least a part of them at this period, this point in time, the house of Judah. Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 8, it says, And I saw when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, had gone after other gods, had committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. It goes on to establish that he did not, at least at this time, divorce the house of Judah, but he did divorce the house of Israel. And it should be understood that at least it's probably the reason he didn't divorce the house of Judah, even though she was just as guilty of the house of Israel, was that his son, Yeshua the Messiah, would not be born out of wedlock. And so he retained this relationship with Judah, even though she did not deserve it. Hosea 1 further describes this divorcement. We won't go there now, but we will at a later time. And then in Hosea 8 and verse 8, we're told the following. It says, Israel, i.e. the house of Israel, that is swallowed up, Israel is swallowed up, now shall they be among the Gentiles, i.e. the non-Israelite Gentile nations in this particular case, and continuing, as a vessel wherein is no pleasure. It's stated this way in 2 Kings chapter 17, verses 18 and 20. Verse 18, Therefore Yahweh was very angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah only, or the house of Judah in this case. Verse 20, And Yahweh rejected all the seed of Israel and afflicted them and delivered them into the hand of spoilers until he had cast them out of his sight. As a consequence of this divorcement and disbursement, according to Hosea 1:9, the 10 northern tribes would no longer be known as Yahweh's people or Israelites, since Israel literally means ruling. Israel literally means ruling with El, which is the shortened form of Elohim, or what is translated in our English versions as God, ruling with God. That's what Israel means. Ruling with God, and thus they would, because they were no longer his helpmeet, no longer his wife, being divorced out of that relationship, they no longer ruled with El. And thus they were no longer known as his people, and eventually through their disbursement, they lost their identity as Israelites. Now, let's pause and think about the ramifications of all of this. If the descendants of the house of Israel were no longer to be known as or called Israelites, and they were to be scattered amongst and swallowed up by the non-Israelite nations, what do you suppose they were called or known as? Well, wouldn't you think that they probably adopted the names of the nations among whom they lived? And by the way, archaeologist Raymond Capp fully establishes that that's exactly what happened. There have been over 400 Assyrian cuneiform tablets, and Assyria was the ones who took the house of Israel into captivity, and by the way, the biggest majority of the part of the house of Judah into captivity, and then dispersed them amongst the non-Israelite Gentiles. And in those cuneiform tablets, it establishes how their names, they did lose their names, and their names became names either given to them by the nations amongst whom they were dispersed, or even the names of those nations that they were dispersed amongst. Also, collectively, don't you think that they might have just been known as or called Goy in the Hebrew or Ethnos in the Greek? Or in the common 20th century English vernacular as just Gentiles? Something to think about. Historian Walter Hutchinson, in Volume 2, page 590 of Hutchinson's History of the Nations, wrote the following, quote, In consequence of Jeroboam's, who was the king of the house of Israel after the division, ambition, aided by the weakness of Solomon's successor Rehoboam, who was the king of the house of Judah, at about the year 937 B.C., there were formed the rival and often hostile kingdoms of Judah and Israel, the latter of which, House of Israel, lost its identity by the capture of Samaria in 722 B.C., while the southern kingdom of Judah maintained its independence till 586 B.C. Now also, under the heading Tribes Lost Ten, in the 1905 Jewish Encyclopedia, volume 12 and page 249, we find the following, quote, If the ten tribes have disappeared, meaning, and I'm adding this, went out of existence. If the ten tribes have disappeared, the literal fulfillment of the prophecies would be impossible. If they have not disappeared, obviously they must exist under a different name. End of that quote. Thus, this clue can be summed up in the following manner. The house of Israel was divorced by Yahweh, lost their identity as Israelites, and became known collectively or generically as simply Gentiles. The next clue is that these scattered and Gentilized descendants of the house of Israel, or at least a remnant of them, were not to be left in that state of banishment forever, but were to be called out from among the non-Israelite Gentiles and be reunited with the house of Judah. Let's turn, if you would, to Ezekiel chapter 37 in this case. Ezekiel chapter 37, and we'll be reading verses 21 and 22 at this time. Ezekiel 37, verse 21, "And say unto them, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, Behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, whether they be gone, and will gather them on every side, and bring them into their own land. Verse 22, And I will make them..." Now, by the way, the children of Israel spoken of in verse 21 are specifically... go back and read the context, is specifically in this part, or at this juncture, or in this verse, speaking of the descendants of the house of Israel. Okay, verse 22, "And I will make them one nation." Now the two, the whole context is dealing with the reuniting of the house of Israel and the house of Judah. "I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all, and they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all." Now here's how verse 21 reads in the NASV. King James it says, "And I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen." That's translated from the Hebrew word goy, and they chose in this case to say from among the heathen. They could have just as easily translated it as Gentiles or nations. New American Standard translates it this way. "And say to them, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, Behold, I will take the sons of Israel, descendants of the house of Israel, from among the nations where they have gone." Now, here's one of those prophecies that Judeo-Christianity just does not know what to do with. First, because they are unable to identify both parties of this prophecy, and you must have two parties in order to fulfill this prophesied reunion. They're at a loss at what to do with this, because they simply do not have two parties, at least in their theology. They do not have two parties to find them or have them reunited. To say the least, they're confused about who the Jews are in both the Bible and society today, and they have absolutely no idea who that house of Israel would be today. Consequently, they are also unable to see this prophecy and others like it that they are actually fulfilled in the New Testament. And so they either try to ignore this prophesied reunion altogether, or they sidestep it by declaring that it was fulfilled at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, which the books of Ezra and Nehemiah absolutely prove themselves did not happen, or that it's yet to be fulfilled at the second advent of Christ, when in fact the prophet Micah very clearly prophesied that this reunion is to be accomplished at the first advent of Yeshua. Turn to Micah chapter 5, and with me read verses 2 and 3. And verse 2 should sound very familiar to you. We find it fulfilled in the New Testament at a specific event that I think all of you will recognize. Not at the second advent of Christ, but rather at the first advent of Christ. Listen closely. Verse 2, "But thou, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall be come forth unto me, that is, to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting." Of course, fulfilled in Yeshua the Christ at his birth, or at the time of his birth, the advent, his first advent here on earth. And then verse 3 says, "Therefore will he," God, "give them up," the house of Israel, "until the time that she which travaileth has brought forth, then the remnant," at this time of this first advent of Christ, "then the remnant of his brethren shall return," the house of Israel, "shall return unto the children of Israel," in this case being the house of Judah. In other words, Micah is also prophesying this reunion of these two houses of Israel, the house of Israel and the house of Judah, but very clearly identifies it as happening at the first advent, or about around the time of the first advent of Christ, not the second, like many try to make it today. So, not only was the house of Israel to be dispersed among the non-Israelite Gentiles, but they were also to be called back from amongst the Gentiles and reunited with the house of Judah. The next clue is that those called back were to be christened sons of the living God. If you will, turn with me now to Hosea chapter 1. Again, as I pointed out to you, we're doing some scriptural Sherlock homework here. Hosea chapter 1, in verses 9 and 10. It says, "Then said God, call his name Lo-Ami," one of the descendants of Hosea and his adulterous wife. Then said God, call his name Lo-Ami, for ye are not, speaking now, this is all indicative of what was going to happen to the house of Israel. You can read it for yourself and find that to be the case. He says, "For ye, the house of Israel, are not my people, and I will not be your God." They're being divorced. Verse 10 then follows up and says, "Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are sons of the living God." They're first divorced, dispersed among the nations, but here they are, once again prophesied to return back to the husband that had previously divorced them. And as a result, they would become known as sons of the living God. We're told essentially the same thing. And I've never correlated these two passages before until I put this message together, but we're told essentially the same thing in the New Testament. In John chapter 1, in verses 11 through 13, it says, "And he came unto his own, and his own received him not." Now, who were his own? There's no question. I mean, nobody can read into this non-Israelites, because this is before the death of Christ. And everybody knows that nobody tries to preach that non-Israelites were brought into the picture until after the death of Christ. So there's no question. We're talking about Israelites here. John 1, verse 11 again, it says, "And he came," Yahshua, "came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him of his own," at least a remnant of them, "as many as received him," the remnant of his own, "to them gave he power to become sons of God," sons of the living God, "even to them that believe on his name, which were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God." How often that verse is that people have tried to attempt to use it and apply it to non-Israelite peoples, when in fact it very clearly is dealing with Israelite peoples in fulfillment of what we find written in Hosea 1:10 about the bringing back of the people of the house of Israel. But it should be noted here, it shouldn't escape our notice, it's a good point time to point it out, that in relation to what it does say, that a claim to genetics alone, claim to being the descendants of Israel, to being genetic Israelites, means nothing. Only by being born above as an Israelite do we ever become something acceptable in God's sight. We were divorced, and only through the death of Yeshua the Christ, Yahweh Yeshua, could we be brought back into the relationship with Him. And so genetics alone mean nothing, even though it is His bride, His previous wife, that God has was that it's prophesied that God would return to bring back. But only those who will remarry him through the death, burial, and resurrection of his son mean anything to God. Genetics alone mean nothing. Now, what's another name for sons of the living God? How about Christians? In other words, these Israelites had lost their identity and had become known as Gentiles, and who at least a remnant of them would be called Christians. They had been Israelites, lost their identity of Israelites, became collectively known as Gentiles, and who at least a remnant of them would become known as Christians. Now here's something else that most of Christendom is uninformed about. they understand that God's people were to be given a new name, Christians, as prophesied in Isaiah 62, 1 and 2, and fulfilled in Acts chapter 11 and verse 26. But they failed to qualify this prophecy in Isaiah as being made to and about Israelites, not non-Israelites. Again, we continually have this misapplication of prophecies that are very clear, very specific, applied to Israelites, and then applied randomly to non-Israelites in the New Testament. You can check out the context of Isaiah 62 for yourselves, and you'll find that it's very clearly a prophecy to Israel, about Israel, and for Israel, that they would be a people who, having lost their identity, would later become known as the sons of the living God or as Christians. Now, the last clue at this time that I want to make mention of is that we're told in Genesis 48 that Abraham's great-great-grandson, Ephraim, and Ephraim, by the way, in prophecy, is always representative of the house of Israel. Don't miss that. That his, Ephraim's descendants, were to become, a multitude of nations. Genesis 48:19 again reads, "And he, speaking of Manasseh, also shall be great, but truly his younger brother, Ephraim, shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations." Now note, it does not say, as some have twisted it to say, that many non-Israelite nations were to become Abraham's or Ephraim's descendants, but rather that Abraham's or Ephraim's Israelite descendants were to become a multitude of nations. Rather than just being known as Israelites, there'd be many nations who would have their own identity, you could say. Or one might even translate this phrase, the multitude of nations, one might translate it as a fullness of Gentiles, which is a clue that we will deal with at a future date. Now, here are the clues to date. That first, there are both non-Israelite and Israelite Gentiles. That a portion of the Israelite nations, specifically the 10-tribed house of Israel, were divorced by Yahweh and scattered amongst non-Israelite Gentiles. That these Israelites would lose their identity as Israelites and collectively become known simply as Gentiles. That a remnant of these people would be called out from amongst the non-Israelite Gentiles where they had been scattered. That they would be christened sons of the living God or called Christians. And that these same people would become a multitude of nations or a fullness of Gentiles. In the New Testament, we're told that this Gentile mystery somehow fulfills the Word of God, specifically the Scriptures of the prophets. So, armed with those previous clues, or if you prefer, those prophecies, let's proceed by examining some Old Testament prophecies discussed in the New Testament regarding Gentiles, and see if we cannot decipher the code and further unravel the riddle of the Gentiles. Let's begin by turning to Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9 and verses 23 and 24 to begin. Verse 23, "And that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he had afore prepared unto glory, even us whom he also called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles." Now once again, when most of modern Christendom reads verse 24, believing that the Jews in this verse represent all 12 tribes of Israel, they thus conclude that the Gentiles here and in the rest of the book of Romans are non-Israelites. But being that their first conclusion is erroneous, that being that the terms Jews in this passage represent all 12 tribes of Israel, their second conclusion regarding the Gentiles is also invalid. Once again, nowhere in Scriptures, in either the Old or New Testaments alike, is the term Jews ever employed to describe all 12 tribes of Israel. Never, not once in the whole Bible, is the term Jews, and we must get this in our heads, is it ever representative of all 12 tribes of Israel. As I previously pointed out, it's a term used exclusively to designate the descendants of either the tribe or the house of Judah. Thus they became known as Judahites, or what in later English versions was changed to Jews. Thus, there's no immediate reason to conclude that the Gentiles referred to this passage in contrast to the Judahites must be non-Israelites. If indeed Jews represented all 12 tribes, then there would maybe be a case for saying, well, then these Gentiles have to be non-Israelites. But with the clue, knowing that there are non-Israelite and Israelite Gentiles alike, and understanding that the Jews do not represent all 12 tribes of Israel, then there's no reason to conclude that these Gentiles must be non-Israelites. Also, don't miss the fact that with the proper understanding for the term Jews, we have now identified one of the two parties, the house of Judah, prophesied to be reunited in Ezekiel 37, Hosea 1 and 2, and Micah 5. Now, we have several clues within this passage, Romans chapter 9 itself, as to who these Gentiles truly are. Look at verse 23 once again. Verse 23, and it says, that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he had afore prepared unto glory. First, let's take in the phrase, vessels of mercy. Now, not that Yahweh cannot also be a God of mercy to non-Israelite Gentiles, but who specifically was it prophesied that they would receive Yahweh's mercy? And as I went through these passages, I wish I had time to read them all to you, but I don't. But I will provide four of them here. Isaiah 14:1, listen to these. For Yahweh will have mercy on Jacob and will yet choose Israel. Sometime in the future, God is saying, I will yet have mercy on Israel. Isaiah 54:5-8, it says, for thy maker is thine husband, Yahweh of hosts is his name, and thy Redeemer the Holy One of Israel. The God of the whole earth shall he be called. For Yahweh has called thee as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit, and a wife of youth when thou wast refused, saith thy God. For a small moan I have forsaken thee, but with great mercies I will gather thee, bring you back. Verse 8, in a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment, but with everlasting kindness I will have mercy on thee, saith Yahweh thy Redeemer. Thy Redeemer husband. Ezekiel 39:22-25, it says, so the house of Israel shall know that I am Yahweh their God from that day and forward. And the heathen shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they trespassed against me. Therefore hid I my face from them, and gave them into the hand of their enemies. So fell they all by the sword. According to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions have I done unto them, and hid my face from them. Therefore thus saith the Lord Yahweh, now will I bring again the captivity of Jacob, and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel, and will be jealous for my holy name. Israel, Israel, Israel. Again, Zechariah 10 and verse 6, and I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph, or Israel, and I will bring them again to place them, for I have mercy upon them, and they shall be as though I had not cast them off, for I am Yahweh their God, and will hear them. Over and over again, Israelites are prophesied for God's mercy. It was Israelites from both the house of Judah and the house of Israel who were prophesied to receive God's mercy. Not once non-Israelites. Now, again, I'm not saying that God can't have mercy on non-Israelite Gentiles. But what I'm telling you, at least when I did the quick preview I did, there's not one scripture, not one prophecy that prophesies God will have mercy on them. Specifically, he was dealing with his mercy to be brought back or brought once again to the house of Israel. On to the next clue. In Romans 9:23-24, it says, which in that same verse, in which he had afore, these vessels of mercy, which he had afore before, before time, prepared unto glory. First, to whom do the scriptures say the glory belongs? It's probably not a question that you hear asked from most pulpits, but it's a legitimate question. To whom do the scriptures say that the glory belongs? Well, the answer to that question is found right here in the same chapter. Romans chapter 9 and verses 3 and 4. It says, for I could wish that I myself, Paul is writing, of course, were accursed from the Christ for my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. Now, there's going to be no way to spiritualize this one. He's talking about people in the flesh, his kinsmen, verse 4, who are Israelites, to whom pertaineth, New American Standard says, belongs, the adoption and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the service of God and the promises. We've often talked about the fact that the covenants belong to Israel, that the law belongs to Israel, that the promises belong to Israel. But here it also says that the glory belongs to Israel. Also, Isaiah 28:5 declares, "In that day shall Yahweh of hosts be for a crown of glory, and for a diadem of beauty unto the residue," or the remnant, "of his people." His people, of course, no question, being Israel. It also declares that this glory was prepared beforehand for these people, as prophesied, as I just read, in Isaiah 28, etc. Well, this is language of predestination, if you will. Well, let me ask this question. Who do the Scriptures say were predestined for this purpose? Once again, the Apostle Paul provides us with the answer in the book of Romans. We don't have to go far back, just one chapter in Romans 8. We'll tie it in with a couple other spots in Romans. But beginning in Romans 8, verse 28, it says, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to His purpose." And many people can quote, many Christians can quote that verse, but what they don't go on to read or really center in on what it says next. Verse 29, For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called, and whom he called, them he also justified, and whom he justified, them he also glorified. Now, note verse 29, or note the phrase in verse 29, the very first phrase, which says, "for whom he did foreknow." This is the exact same Hebrew phrase that Paul uses in Romans chapter 11. It's translated in the King James a little bit differently. In the New American Standard, I know it's the exact same phrase, even in the English and in the Hebrew. It's the exact same phrase, "whom he did foreknow." Is translated in Romans chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, and Paul provides us exactly who it was whom he foreknew. "I say then, hath God cast away his people? God forbid. For I also am an Israelite, of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin." God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. "Wot ye not what the Scriptures say of Eliath," and so forth and so on. Same phrase. And he identifies those people whom he foreknew as Israelites. They were the people who were predestined for salvation in Christ, with individual choice to reject and walk away from him. But they were the people. It was these people who the Scriptures over and over and over again prophesy that they would be granted salvation in Christ, that salvation was primarily for them, that it was to them whom, that's why Yeshua himself declared in Matthew 15, that it was to these people and only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel to whom he was sent, because they were the predestined people. Let's go now back to Romans 8 and verse 30, and it begins once again as, "Moreover, whom he did predestinate, these he also called." Now, those whom he did foreknow, whom Paul in Romans 11, 1 and 2 identified as Israelites, those whom he did foreknow, whom he, Yahweh, did predestinate, them he also called. Which leads us right back to Romans 9, 23 and 24. Let's read it again. "And that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy," which was prophesied for the Israelites, "which he had afore prepared unto glory," there again, predestination, and the glory belongs to Israel, "even us whom he hath called, not of the Judahites only," the house of Judah, "but also of the Gentiles." And the question is, non-Israelite Gentiles or Israelite Gentiles? Well, the context, letting the Bible be its own commentary, in this case, letting Paul be his own commentary, it can only be Israelite Gentiles that's being dealt with in this passage. Next, note that it says that those whom he called were not only of the Judahites, the house of Judah, but also of the Gentiles. The New American Standard Version translates it from among Gentiles. Now, does that phrase sound familiar? It should. Turn back to keeping your finger in Romans chapter 9 and turn back to Ezekiel chapter 37. Ezekiel chapter 37 and let's begin this time with verse 16 through 21, and we want to center in on verse 22, but let's get the whole situation of what's happening here. Verse 16, "Moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions. Then take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions." Two sticks, two different houses, house of Judah and the house of Israel. Verse 17, "And join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in thy hand." A future reunion of what had been divided, which Micah identifies as happening at some time during the first advent of Christ. "And when the children of thy people shall speak unto thee, saying, Wilt thou not show us what thou meanest by these? Say unto them, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, Behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim," that is the house of Israel, "and the tribes of Israel, his fellows, and will put them with him, even with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in my hand. And the sticks whereon thou writest shall be in thine hand before their eyes. And say unto them, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, Behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen." I will take the children of Israel, the house of Israel, from among the heathen, from among the goy, from among the nations, from among the Gentiles, whither they be gone, and will gather them on every side and bring them unto their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all, and they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all. Did you catch the phrase? From among the heathen, the house of Israel would be brought back from among the heathen, the goy. It could have been translated Gentiles. From among the Gentiles, which is the exact phrase used by Paul in Romans 9 and verse 24, speaking of the house of Israel, that they would be brought from, that these Israelites would be brought from among the Gentiles. Or it could have been translated heathen had that been their prerogative. Not a very good translation. Or it could have been translated nations. In both places, that's exactly what it should have been translated, from among the nations. A direct fulfillment of this prophecy in Ezekiel 37. In other words, Romans 9, 23 and 24 is an explanation, a fulfillment of Ezekiel's 37's prophesied reunion. And both parties have now been identified. The Jews in Romans 9, 23 equal the house of Judah, and the Gentiles in Romans 9, 23 equal the divorced and Gentilized house of Israel. Now, isn't that thrilling to you? At least I hope it is. And can you also see why God called this a mystery? It should be exciting not only to see this prophecy fulfilled, Ezekiel 37 that is ignored or used falsely by the majority of Christendom today, but to also have the mystery begin to unfold before your very eyes. I don't know about you, I find that thrilling. And there's much more to come. Now, just in case you're still not convinced that the Gentiles in these verses in Romans chapter 9 are Israelite Gentiles, then the succeeding verses in Romans 9 should cinch it for you. Back to Romans chapter 9, and we'll begin with verse 23 once again and read through verse 27. Romans 9 and verse 23, it says, "And that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he had afore prepared unto glory, even us, whom he has also called, not of the Jews or house of Judah only, but also from the Gentiles," as we've now very clearly identified as being the house of Israel. But in case you're not convinced, it then goes on, it says, "As he saith also in Hosea, I will call them," and he quotes directly from Hosea 1 and 2, "I will call them my people, which were not my people, and her beloved, which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, Ye are not my people, there they shall be called children of the living God." Now, most people would read with their already foregone conclusion that the Jews equal all Israel and the Gentiles equal all non-Israelites, and that the fact that the Israelites never were, the non-Israelite Gentiles never were his people and never were his beloved, they automatically conclude that that just verifies their conclusion. And they fail to do what Paul basically is telling us to do, and that is, he's saying, just as it says in Hosea, or go back to Hosea, and it'll prove to you that this is a fulfilled prophecy from Hosea 1 and 2. And I don't have time to do it in this message. We'll probably do it in one of the future messages in this series. But I challenge you to go back and read Hosea 1 and 2. Better yet that I don't go back and do it. So you get no influence from me whatsoever other than what we've already read. You go back and read Hosea 1 and 2, and I challenge you to find anywhere in Hosea 1 and 2 where any mention of non-Israelite Gentiles can be found. You go back and you examine it. If these statements apply to non-Israelites, then you should be able to find it very clearly in what Hosea, or what Yahweh is telling Hosea. But indeed, you'll find that there is no non-Israelite Gentiles in the passage. It's dealing with the divorce of the house of Israel, their disbursement amongst the non-Israelite Gentiles, and the prophesied reunion with the house of Judah, and more exciting, their remarriage to Yahweh, Yeshua. There's simply no question that these Gentiles, or these ethnos, Gentiles, nations in Romans 9, are one and the same as those goy Gentiles nations described by Yahweh and prophesied by the prophets to be reunited with the house of Judah at the time of the first advent of the Messiah, i.e., the descendants of the house of Israel. Praise Yahweh. I hope you can praise Yahweh with me. For just as the Apostle Paul was inspired to write, the mystery of the Gentiles is beginning to be made manifest by the scriptures of the prophets. You don't have to accept my word as a preacher, you shouldn't accept anybody's word as a preacher. Paul wasn't inspired to write that this mystery would be made manifest by any of us, but they're made manifest by the prophets, just like you would expect God to do, letting the Bible be its own commentary. That's what you should expect. And the prophets will manifest even more in the coming message. God bless until then.